Welcome, my friends, to the Sage Akwe Radio Hour, your home for free and critical thinking, and I'm your host, Mike Williams. Tonight, my very special guest is Deanna Spingola. Deanna is an author, researcher, and radio host. She investigates government and corporate corruption as it relates to the faltering liberties of American citizens and the war-targeted populations of other countries. Deanna is not afraid to address controversial issues, as you will certainly hear in this interview on Sandy Hook. Deanna's recent books include her Ruling Elite trilogy, along with her newest book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. For this show, we originally planned to discuss Dwight Eisenhower's Rhine-Meadow camps, which resulted in over 1 million German deaths after World War II. But as we got into our conversation and started chatting about her book, Screening Sandy Hook, we ended up staying on the topic as Deanna shared her research and perspective on the mass shooting which took place back on December 14, 2012. In Screening Sandy Hook, Deanna examines the role psychiatric drugs played in the shooting incident, and in our conversation, she explains that the real Sandy Hook conspiracy was not about guns, but about protecting the pharmaceutical industry. I asked Deanna to tell us how her research began in earnest after reading Gary Allen's seminal book, None Dare Call It Conspiracy, and here is what she had to say.
I was very skeptical about things that I heard in the media, and I've always been very curious. I've always been kind of a outside of the what other people thought. I've always been independent. I don't go along with the herd mentality kind of a thing, or with consensus thinking. I think I've always been a critical thinker.
Yeah.
I think I spent a lot of time alone as a child. And, which is fine. It gives you time to think about things and to be comfortable. I've always been very comfortable with myself and, don't need to have a lot of people around in order to feel okay.
So at what age, if you had to put an age on it, Deanna, did you start to really understand that, you know, things are really not the way we're told they are?
Probably in my mid-20s, I would say.
Okay.
And I'm not going to tell you how old I am now.
That's okay. I shall not ask. I'm a gentleman. No worries. And so, you know, so you've been going since your 20s. And then what happened? Did you start writing soon once you had that realization? Was it a couple of years later?
No, I actually start talking to my friends about all of these things, and I joined the John Birch Society, which I found, I soon discovered that they were pretty static, that they really weren't moving forward, that it just, they made a lot of noise and had a lot of great plans, but they never came to fruition.
Okay.
And then when I talked to my friends about what I was perceiving, they thought I was nuts. And, in fact, I probably lost a few friends. And then I got busy with my family. And so I really, really didn't start writing until about 2005. And that, well, I was busy also before 2005. I was single. I was a single parent. And I was working very hard. I was representing about 5 different companies out of New York. I was traveling in 5 different states. So I was very, very busy. And during that period of time, I did write a couple of quilt books, which were kind of mathematically intricate quilt books. I designed some new techniques and whatnot. It was just something to do in the evening because I didn't want to just sit around and watch television. And I always have to be busy doing something. And so I did these, a couple of quilt books, and then I created a quilt line. And then about 2005, I had remarried, and, I just started reading a lot of stuff on the internet, and I thought, well, gosh, I'm going to start writing articles, which I did for several websites. And then a couple in about in December of 2009, two publishers approached me within 2 days of each other and asked me if I would like to write a book based on some of the content of my articles. And I accepted the first proposal because I just thought that it was fair. And I spent a couple of years working on what came to be three books. And just before the first book was to come out, the publisher approached me and said, "Oh, you've got to change things. We can't have you using certain words and really we can't have you referencing certain ethnic groups.
Interesting.
People are just going to have to figure this out by looking at the last name." And then he wanted to give me an assistant to, in other words, a handler to redirect me, apparently. And this person who he wanted to assign me had never written a book and didn't have very broad views. Was certainly subjective in her views. And I thought, heck with this. I'm going to just publish my own book. I don't need this publisher. But I did offer, write to the other publisher, the one that had approached me after this first publisher. And I said, well, I am no longer with the other publisher. If you are interested, and I never heard back from the guy. And I thought, this is very suspicious.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, it's sounding suspicious to me.
And so I've just plodded along on my own and done my own thing. But one thing I will say, that when a person is sincerely engaged in research and they're objective, and in order to do any kind of research, you really have to look at both sides of any issue in order to draw your own conclusions. You simply cannot accept the word of the victors in regard to any war or in regard to anything. You really need to look objectively at things, which I did. And if people are serious about their research, that is what they are going to do. Which is what I did. And so within a very short time of writing and rewriting and researching for my trilogy, it just opened up my eyes to a whole different view of things. And, so it was really, really a blessing that the publisher opted not to publish my work, even though I had seen a different side during the writing of the book. The more research I did, the deeper into things that I went, found that we have been lied to so frequently and yeah, for so long, that it is just kind of incredible.
Do you think, Deanna, that the publisher was attempting to manage your output, and then by managing your output, they would neutralize your articles and your research?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And when the publisher first approached me, he was telling me that his father used to work for the CIA, which is like saying, oh, my father used to be in the mafia, but then he quit. So I thought that should have been the first clue.
Yeah.
But I just wasn't really astute enough to see that. And I think that probably my articles do not represent the depth to which I went in my research. And I think that he assumed that I would write along the same vein and not go any deeper. But as I said, the more research that you do, the more you learn and the more objective that you become. So I think maybe, well, I don't know. It was just kind of interesting. There was no contract. He didn't fulfill the obligations to me. So it was very easy to break the contract because he had not fulfilled it. And I just, like I said, I just plotted on my own.
Now, the trilogy, Deanna, is that The Ruling Elite? And you have, I guess, three books? Yeah. And then I noticed that you have a current book. Is it Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences?
Yes.
Would you want to just talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes. I really don't address what the claims are within the alternative media. There are a lot of claims that were made just within the first month after the event that were, I think, setting the stage, setting up the arguments, the agenda, and certainly represents some interest that I question, because how can you make statements within a week or two after an event? Because even with 9/11, it took a couple of years for people to really wake up to the fact that, gosh, there are some things about 9/11 that are not adding up. And for people to make claims so soon after Sandy Hook, well, I just thought it was very strange, because the official reports didn't come out until quite, well, about a year later. Now, not that official reports are always stellar examples of government truth, but when you consider that a lot of people, compartmentalized people, work on putting those reports together, they are going to represent some truth. I mean, they can't get 100 people to lie about stuff and to make things up and to involve and actually to claim that a whole city, a whole town of 28,000 people are going to lie about something. And so the book itself does not actually counter what I call the hoaxologist. It doesn't counter all of their claims. I have done some critiques on some of the claims, but what the book does is it takes a whole different direction. Well, what it does, it presents an idea, a scenario of what is happening to our children and to people in general as a result of the vaccines and the psychiatric drugs that people are taking, which are massive. I mean, so many people are on psych drugs that I have chosen to focus on that. And given the events in Connecticut and the direction that they have gone with mental health, and considering that 37 states have altered their mental health views and increased their mental health budgets as a result of Sandy Hook, and when you consider that Texas was used as a model for the dissemination of psychiatric drugs within the juvenile population and within the prison population and across the board population. And then when you also consider that Texas is also currently pushing a mandatory vaccine schedule that is much more demanding than any other state, I chose to follow that focus.
Okay.
Rather than say, oh, it's all about guns. Because if it were about guns, in the Chicago area, I live in the Chicago suburbs, in any given weekend, if the federal government were going to focus on guns, there are lots and lots and lots of opportunities and sufficient murders just within the city of Chicago, which has strict, strict gun control laws. Then they could certainly focus on the murders in Chicago to say, oh, we've got to take these guns away. And I think what Sandy Hook was, or what it became, was, or what the movement became, was a damage control operation to protect the pharmaceutical industry.
Very interesting. So are you of the mindset that it was a false flag, and that the false flag's intent was the psychiatric aspect that you just talked about?
I I do not believe that it was a false flag. I did find Social Security death index records for all of the children and for all of the adults. Usually when you're talking about a false flag usually involves, it is usually a national focus, which of course gun control has always been a national focus. The media has always been anti-gun. The current administration has always been anti-gun. And of course, communism has always been anti-gun. The first thing that they want to do is seize guns. But when you're talking about a false flag usually is associated with blaming another country for something. Okay? So false flag, I think, is the wrong term to use when you're even talking about Sandy Hook. For instance, with 9/11, they say, okay, it was a false flag in order for the government to attack Afghanistan first and then go into Iraq after they had built some objectives and after they had gotten some support from Congress and whatnot. And when you're talking about a false flag, for instance, with Vietnam, then you blame the North Vietnamese for attacking a ship, or when you're talking about the false flag for the Second World War, then you say, okay, it was the attack on Pearl Harbor. When you're talking about a false flag for World War I, it was the Lusitania. So it's always to blame another country. So false flag, when you're talking about Sandy Hook, using the term false flag is incorrect.
Well, how about if somebody referred to it or framed it as an orchestrated or engineered event to some degree, maybe not entirely, but there were aspects of it which were engineered?
I do not think that it was engineered, because if you look at the background of Adam Lanza, which I did, I looked at his background, and you also have to look at all of the other mass shootings that have occurred with the introduction of Prozac and other SSRIs, then you recognize that, heck, this is unusual in the fact that it was children who were shot, 6 and 7 year olds who were shot, as opposed to high school students or to relatives. And usually, in the other mass shootings, some of which had occurred in malls and other places, it was somebody that was attending the school at the time. So, there were some anomalies. But I initially thought, well, this is very strange. It's very strange that they would, okay, for instance, one of the first claims that came out was that Robbie Parker was an actor.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
That came out within 24 hours after the event. Okay. Somebody took 27 seconds from an 18 plus minute video and made the claim that he was an actor. And I think, okay, gosh, I mean, that's quite a claim to make within 24 hours based on a very small fraction of a 18 minute press conference. So I thought that was a little strange. And then I looked at some of the other claims, and, you know, claims about Christmas trees and other nonsense. And I thought, well, this isn't evidence. This is nonsense. Just because they have 26 Christmas trees and they brought them out from behind the firehouse and decorated them doesn't mean that Sandy Hook was a hoax. Because in fact, the firehouse had been selling Christmas trees at Christmas time for 13 years. So the claims that were made were so superficial and based on no evidence at all, but just circumstances that were very, very easy to explain. I thought, well, if this is the evidence that they're using, then you have to question, why are they doing this? Is this some sort of damage control operation? And when you look at the claims, which were all made, there were about 14 claims that were all made within 6 weeks. think, this is very strange. Because as I mentioned, even with 9/11, it took people to really think about this. It took a book, usually, I woke up to 9/11, based on a book that I read. And, so I just think that, this was very rapid, and it just raised questions in my mind. And so, they were saying that,
what were some of those claims, Deanna? I mean, just so the audience get a little acclimated, you said they made these claims. What claims are you specifically referring to that they made soon after Sandy Hook?
I did a critique because, I had invited a person on my radio program to talk about Sandy Hook, and the lady responded that I didn't know the material well enough. And I had been finishing up my third book, so I really didn't look at Sandy Hook immediately. But she said, well, you don't know the material well enough. And I thought, the material? There's material that I should know that I don't know well enough? So what does that mean, mm-hmm. that I don't know the material well enough? And so I did this, I did a critique of the material so that I could learn. And that's why you have guests on. Okay. When I have a guest on a program, I have that guest on because I want to learn something. I want to know something.
Exactly.
To learn something from an expert. And so the first thing, within a very short period of time, they made 14 claims. The first claim, no children were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Number two, Sandy Hook was not an operating school. Number three, they showed an image of a purported Social Security death index and stated that Adam Lanza had died the day before. Number four, they promoted the idea that Adam Lanza did not exist. Then they promoted the idea, number five, and this by January 16th, 2013, that logistically Adam Lanza could not have carried off the shooting. In other words, he didn't weigh enough, he wasn't strong enough, he just could not have done it. Number six, they introduced the idea that satanic worship was part of the whole situation, simply because of the way that one of the infants sucked on her fingers. One of the siblings of one of the children that was killed at Sandy Hook. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Number seven, they introduced the idea that it was all about gun control and disarming the population. Number eight, they reintroduced the scare tactic that the government had FEMA camps and 1.5 billion rounds of .40 caliber hollow point ammunition. They suggested that the Mossad may have been behind Sandy Hook. Number 10, they introduced the idea that other shootings were hoaxes staged by the government. Number 11, they introduced the idea that actors were used at Sandy Hook. Number 12, they introduced the idea that Sandy Hook was a drill. Number 13, they introduced the idea that officials were smirking at Aurora, which they also applied to Sandy Hook. Number 14, they introduced the idea of premeditation. And so I went through I did a critique of the video of the person that I had asked to be on my program. And I also studied the Delphi technique, which is a method that is used to make the favored side appear very sensible and to make the other side appear absolutely ridiculous. And so when you have, in this kind of an environment, you actually have mob censure. In other words, if you have a lot of people that believe in one particular thing, and then you have, another group who questions those ideas of the popular group, then you have self-censorship. In other words, the people who originally came out with this, with all these ideas, actually were framing the debate. And framing the debate is keeping control of the psychological environment. In other words, the first people to introduce a lot of ideas or to introduce a theory will usually have a benefit. In other words, when they talked about, for instance, with the example of the Holocaust, the people who introduced the idea that there was a Holocaust in Germany had about 40 years to impose that theory on the public, because it wasn't till about 1965 that people started questioning whether the Holocaust actually happened. Well, by then you had a big segment of the public totally believing, totally accepting it, because they saw all this evidence. In other words, they saw the dead bodies. They, without even asking, well, maybe those dead bodies weren't Jewish.
Right.
Maybe those were other bodies. And so you had all of this eyewitness testimony, which has now been proven to be false. And so the first group of people on the scene with ideas, with an agenda, with a bunch of theories, usually have the advantage, because they will impose those theories and they will be talking points that they will repeat and repeat and repeat and get others to repeat to the point that they will be accepted. And even if those theories are refuted with scientific evidence and refuted with records and documents and science, people will still believe the first ideas, the first theories that they heard. In other words, if you read a headline in the newspaper and they retract that headline or that story under the headline, 3 weeks later, people are still going to remember the initial headline.
Yeah.
And they're never going to give the retraction any credibility. And so that is the benefit, the hoaxologist had with regard to Sandy Hook. And it's also interesting, and I note it in my book, that there were videos that came out within just a very short period of time, where within a week there were 11 million views of one video. And one of the Fox networks came out within the week and said, well, there might be a psychiatric drug issue relative to what happened at Sandy Hook. That video just died. It wasn't promoted. It wasn't pushed. And so any psychiatric association with Adam Lanza simply did not exist. And when you look at his background, when you look at the reports that came out from the Child Advocate's Office, where it talks about his early childhood, even when you read the article that was written by Andrew Solomon in The New Yorker, where he talks about his early, he didn't speak, he didn't interact with his parents until he was 3 years old. He was a headbanger. He had all of these autistic, antisocial kinds of characteristics. That says something, because a lot of these children who are vaccine damaged usually go on to take psychiatric drugs because they become a target for the pharmaceutical industry. It's, for instance, all the children in the primary grades who are on drugs for ADHD. I mean, you have to look at this as to what is happening to our children overall. And then when you look at the pharmaceutical industry and their objectives to have the majority of the population on psych drugs, and then when you look at the numbers, and then when you look at the conclusions of the advisory commission that was called in Connecticut, and what they are saying and what other organizations in Connecticut are saying is, oh, Adam Lanza just didn't have access to the appropriate drugs. We need to do more screening. We need to screen children when they're infants to prevent this. We need to be screening children from the day they're born until they go to school. And that's where I came up with the name Screening Sandy Hook. No, we don't need to screen children. We do not need to screen 12-month-old babies to see if they might become a killer. We need to screen Sandy Hook and look at it in a different light and not in the light of those first claims, but to really look at this.
Yeah, very interesting perspective, Deanna. I'm listening very intently here because even going back to Aurora, the Batman shooting, when I look back at that, that came and went very quickly. It appeared to be they had another person, I forgot the fellow's name, who did the shooting. And, he got some headlines for about a week or so, or maybe a little longer, 10 days, and then we don't hear from him anymore.
Right.
It's a very interesting perspective you have, I have to admit. I mean, that damage control, essentially, is what you're saying, to kind of cover up the fact that these SSRIs, these psychotropic drugs, are wreaking havoc with young people's minds, and they're going off and doing these types of things.
Right. And SSRIs do create suicide and homicide ideation.
Yeah.
It's on the black label. The companies that make those know about this. They stack their clinical trials. And look at the sponsors who sponsor the mainstream media.
So the book for the audience is Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. That's what Deanna is taking us through here. It sounds like it is a very, very interesting read.
I thought that it was relevant. I really did.
No, I think it's great that you have that perspective, because we have to get these different perspectives out there. Otherwise, like you said, people will take something, grab onto it, and run with it. And, and that's part of the agenda, by the way, right, is to get people running in all different directions.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, they're very good. They're very good at getting people to scatter and fight with each other.
And that is what has happened.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I was going to ask you whether you're following Wolfgang Helbig's work.
I did interview him on, March 4th of last year. And it was, I must say that he is an absolute master at the Delphi technique, because I came off looking like a witch, because I was asking very direct questions, and I admit that I got frustrated. I was, if a man had been interviewing him, it wouldn't have been as bad, but it was not my typical interview style. What I did was, I asked him some very direct questions, and he had actually called into a program that I was on previously and asked me to stop critiquing, this person that I was critiquing. He was very adamant about it. And I thought, well, gosh, he wants me to be quiet about this. He doesn't want me to be critiquing this information that this woman had put out. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Why would he be interested in that? And I asked him about his address, because he had just, put up a website in, I believe, October of 2012. And it was the Children's Institute for Safety or something like that. And it had a street address and a suite number and this kind of thing. And I said, well, tell us about your business. Is your address such and such and such and such? And he said, yes, that is our address. And I said, well, isn't it a fact that that address is actually the address of the local UPS office, where you simply have a slot? And then he got kind of upset. He says, well, we don't need an office. And he took the website down 4 days after the interview. And I outed him in a couple of places. In fact, I had called the mortician that had handled 11 of the bodies from Sandy Hook. And when I called them, and I understood that Helbig had also called them, and I called the mortician, and I said, verified that he had handled 11 of the bodies. And I asked Hal Big about this, and I said, I understand that you called the mortician. And he said, I don't remember. And I said, well, when I called, I asked, and they said that you did. And then he suddenly remembered, he said, yes, they handled 11 of the bodies. And this was right after he'd said, well, if they can answer these 16 questions, then I will believe that somebody was killed at Sandy Hook. And I followed up with this question about the mortician. So within 1 minute, he went from saying, well, yes, if they can answer these 16 questions, then I believe that 16 people, or that 20 children died at Sandy Hook. And then he admitted that, yeah, 11 people were handled by this mortician. So, I mean, it was just an interesting interview, but people were so focused on the fact that I was treating him with a little bit of disrespect, with a little bit of skepticism, that they didn't pick up some of the things that I was trying to get out of him. In fact, in all of these reviews, at YouTube, people were reviewing the audio, and they were just, oh, they were cruel, calling me the C word and calling me all kinds of names. But they didn't say anything about, okay, but remember, she did get him to admit that 11 people were dead. She did, ask him about his office, which wasn't an office. So there were things that I did get out of that interview that I wanted to get out of that interview, but he was so quick and easy to turn the table on me, turn the tables, because, you know, he wanted to give out his address and his phone number, which I thought was not a very good idea. And so he said, well, Deanna, if I want to share this and, you know, I want the audience to have my phone number, it made me look like I was trying to keep him from telling the truth and being so transparent. And he did this immediately after I had outed him about not having an office. So it was, he's very good at this.
Yeah, he comes across as a very
sincere,
easygoing, regular guy type of thing. And I say, I don't know, to be honest with you. And I find this very interesting because he recently did an interview on InfoWars. And if I'm not mistaken, he reiterated the fact that nobody died at Sandy Hook. And now you're saying that you got him to admit that they handled 11 bodies.
Right. Well, and you note that was number one, absolutely number one, on the 14-point agenda. No children were killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And I do not believe that he actually researched it himself, but is simply relying on other people's research. And the other thing that I noted was that when the official report did come out, I talked to him, I asked him about the official report, and I said, you've read the official report? Well, it's about 7,000 pages. And he was not aware that much of the report was contained in what is referred to as the nine books. It's set up as nine books with a lot of PDF files within each book. And so I asked him about those books, and he says, what books? I don't know anything about any books. I just know about the report. And he was discouraging people from reading the report. Now, I think if you're going to refute what the government says, that you better know what the government says. You cannot refute what the government is trying to tell you unless you know what the government is saying. Now, the report is quite different than a commission, like the Warren Commission or the 9/11 Commission or the commission that was created after during World War II or right after World War II, regarding the Pearl Harbor event. Those commissions were stacked. You stack a commission with the people that are going to give you a preconceived idea. The preconceived idea being the falsification of government reports. And so then people will accept what the commission says without actually going in and looking at the report. support themselves.
Like Alan Dulles overlooking the Kennedy assassination.
Exactly. That's or that magic bullet and all that stuff. Yes, of course. Yes.
Yeah.
And so he was trying to tell people, and he had done this in several places on the internet, which I find very interestingly were scrubbed right after he was on my program, that the references to him saying, oh, don't look at the report. There's nothing in the report. It's just a mess. It's just a big mess. And those comments were scrubbed where he had made them.
Well, what about his claim about the government has this overarching, initiative called a capstone event?
Capstone events are held in one specific place. They are not held in communities. A capstone event, according to what I was able to determine, by speaking to people who actually handle capstone events, there is a specific place where they bring people in to hold these drills. And it is a specific, let me just see if I can find this, because I actually did a lot of research on this capstone thing.
Because when he presents it, it sounds very convincing.
Well, of course. Everything has to be very, very convincing in order for people to believe it. Okay. An integrated capstone event is what they are trying to portray. Okay? The capstone event, it's an exercise run by FEMA to coordinate federal, state, and local emergency response teams in the case of a mass casualty event. But the capstone events, the formal ones, are done in a town, kind of a town that is set up by FEMA in a particular place to which they bring officers and people that they want to train to this area. They don't do them in communities. The other thing is, one of the other claims that they made is that it was a drill. Okay. In the event of a drill, the community has to be notified. They set up signs in the community and the signs say that there's a drill going on, so that people will not think that it's real. They also get the permission of the parents prior to a drill. They usually do it in a closed campus environment. In other words, when school is out for a week, during the summer, or when school is not in session. And there's a lot of arguments, even in high schools. Having a drill where you have students present would be too traumatic. So obviously, they're not going to have a drill at an elementary school where the children are from kindergarten to fourth grade. What parent would sign a consent to have their child exposed to a drill situation where they see a gun? That would be awful.
Well,
parent would do that.
Well, one of the claims is that Sandy Hook was actually a defunct school, that it was not up and running, that it had been shut down and closed off for a couple of years. So their argument would be that, well, they really didn't have to be any kind of sign-offs because, well, the school, there was nobody in the school.
But you have the local newspapers through those years reporting on the events taking place at Sandy Hook. The other thing is that in the video that this woman made, part of the video contained a video that she used that was created by the local newspaper, and that video was made in August of 2009. Okay? It was a back-to-school video made by the local newspaper, the Newtown Bee, and it was made, like I say, in August of 2009 for their back-to-school issue. And they are claiming that the school was closed in 2008. Well, the Newtown Bee would not have been making a video, a back-to-school video, and focus on the Sandy Hook Elementary School if the school were closed. You can't have it both ways.
Yeah. No, very, very interesting, Deanna. Very interesting. You're giving a side of the story or a perspective here that I think people need to think about.
Right. Yeah. But people are so enmeshed in the agenda, in those talking points. Remember that they had a year to impress and to impose those talking points. And in the video that was made, the first thing that they were talking about is that there was no, one of the captions on the screen, I have not seen a single crime scene photograph of the inside or the outside of that school. Well, that was because the official report had not been made public. And in any shooting, we never see images. The media does not show images of mass slaughters. It just doesn't happen. We see it on TV, okay? We see it on TV all the time. We see the blood and gore on TV, and we kind of take it as well, that's the way things are, that people are exposed to all these bloody scenes, when in fact they're not.
Yeah, but couldn't their argument, again, to play devil's advocate, could they say, well, look, you know what? This is something that they do. This is a theme that runs across things like even Oklahoma City, where they confiscated the cameras so that you couldn't really, nobody could really investigate what really went on in Oklahoma City. Was it the bomb outside that blew up the building, or were there bombs inside the Oklahoma City building that blew out? 9/11 with the Pentagon. I mean, there were video that was confiscated. So I think what happens is over time, and we just keep seeing, there's no video for anything. I think that's the point. Like I said, if I play devil's advocate.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. That is true, that there was a lot of video seizure.
Right.
At 9/11. You had some video that was exposed. The Nade brothers, they were somehow positioned before the event on a street where they could get a clear shot of the planes going into the buildings. And that was the only video that was really very popular at the time. But it was a setup before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm just saying that this is like their modus operandi when they have these orchestrated events or when they engineer events. There's just never any video when that seems very, very odd because we live in a surveillance state.
Sure. But what sane person wants to see a pile of dead, bloodied 6-year-old kids.
Yeah.
Okay. That just is not done. And it doesn't matter what crime scene you're talking about, whether you're talking about a single murder, whether you're talking about a mass shooting, you're not going to see the bloody bodies. I'm sorry. The media just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. No, I understand
your point. TV works that way.
Yeah. TV works that way. I understand your point. It just seems to coalesce and play out.
Oh, sure. Sure.
In a funny way, you know?
And it's one of the points that they could say, yes, look, there's no audio, there's no video, so obviously it didn't happen. Well, there's no video because nobody, you know, went in and took pictures. And of course, it was a crime scene.
Well, what about the aerial views? There was no children being.
Yeah, there were.
There were?
Yeah. Yes. There are all kinds of evacuation photos. Just because somebody says there were no evacuation photos doesn't mean that there were no evacuation photos. It simply means that they are telling you that, but if you go online, you will see dozens of evacuation photos. They also say, oh, nobody was crying. Well, I have found pictures, photos, images of a lot of people crying. They also say, well, they set up these websites in advance, and they are counting on the public's not understanding how a DNS record works, how an IP address is assigned, because an IP address is static, okay? It's a unique identifier for a computer that is connected to the internet. Now, if they get assigned a domain name to a computer that was, for instance, I first got my domain, gosh, back in the 90s. But I have not always used it for what I use it now for now. The IP address is always the same, but I might change the domain name that goes on that IP address. So when they say, well, they set up these websites before. No, they did not set up the websites before. The IP address has been there for years. They just assigned a different function to that particular IP address. So it could have been set up, you know, 3 or 4 years ago or a year ago. But if you change the function, the domain name, it's a domain name that is really the key.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to take a look, closer look at the evacuation because, I'm trying to remember. I saw some pictures, but I didn't see how many kids supposedly were at Sandy Hook.
There were just under 500.
Yes. I thought I had a number of 600. Okay. About 500. Well, that's a lot of kids.
That's what they want you to think is 600.
Yeah.
Well, kids can evacuate pretty quickly. I mean, you say when the recess bell rings, I mean, kids are out and gone. Okay.
Yeah.
And you can see all kinds of evacuation pictures.
Okay, I'll take a look. And then just to stick on it just a little bit longer, like, you know, outside they had, I'm probably not going to get the term right, but I believe there's different color-coded tarps, which are, they're color-coded for the purposes of the severity of somebody's injury. So if you're not...
Exactly.
Right. So when we looked at those aerial shots, the helicopter, there was nobody on those tarps. So how would you explain that?
Okay, the tarps, and that was in my part two, and it's very interesting because this was a mass casualty incident, and they have what is called a triage. Now, they use different colors to determine the severity of the patient, the person. Okay, there are... Now, what this one person said, she said, the police can't pronounce people dead. We can't pronounce anyone dead unless they're decapitated. And it's totally obvious. We have to take everyone to the hospital. That's where they pronounce them dead. The police don't have the authority. We don't have the authority. Okay. So when the first responders are responding, you have code green, you have code yellow, you have code red, you have code black. Okay? Now, code black means that the person is deceased. So, they would not have a code black that people could use. In other words, there is what is called the tag that they put on the toe.
Yeah.
Okay? And it has black, you take them to the morgue. Red, it's immediate, life-threatening injury. Delayed is yellow, it's non-life-threatening. And green, it's walking wounded. Okay, if the first responders, the EMTs, are not allowed to determine whether a person is dead, there would be no deceased category for them to use when sorting or triaging bodies.
Okay.
And the tarps that they had out, they had yellow and red. Well, if the people in the building were dead and it was a crime scene, they're not going to carry the dead bodies out and lay them on a yellow tarp. They are going to leave the bodies where they are. It is a crime scene. They were triaged in the building, in the school. And thereafter, when the coroner arrived, he arrived about four hours later, about noonish, they started to then do autopsies or move them out after the police had investigated the crime scene, done all of their investigation. The other thing that was very interesting is that they used an overhead video of the firehouse.
Right.
Okay. And one of the things that I noted And they said, look at all these people walking around the firehouse. They're just going in circles. They're not doing anything. They're just going in one door and out the other door. Are you aware of that?
Yes. Yep. I was going to ask you about that. Yep.
Okay. That was a looped video. If you look at the video, and I do have a link to it on my website, you will see up in the upper left-hand corner of that video, you will see the same gray or silver vehicle going back and forth, back and forth. And you can see that it is looped. And I give the exact minute that you can see that. And I say, watch this part and notice the silver van up in the left go by repeatedly. Very obvious. Okay? So they use this looped video to make it look like people were going around in circles. Okay, that's deceptive. And if they have to resort to deceptive measures like this, using loop video, if they have to claim that nobody can categorize a dead body at the scene, they wouldn't have black on the triage tags. Okay, I mean, these are false claims. To say that the EMTs cannot declare a person dead, that they have to take all the dead bodies to the hospital, is deceptive. And I'm thinking, okay, if they're using these deceptive claims, what else about their claims is deceptive? What else are they telling you that is, not true?
So, Deanna, let me just make sure I have this correctly. So, essentially, from your perspective, it sounds like what you're advocating, or what your research is showing, is that this is a conspiracy to protect the pharmaceutical industry?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. So your perspective is this went down, it was a real event, and then all of a sudden it became known that Adam Lanza was loaded up on psychotropics and SSRIs. Like, okay, this has to be taken care of. And yeah, that was Sandy Hook. It was essentially the covering up, again, from your perspective, of basically the drug industry.
Yes.
Okay.
Because if you look at it in that way, who is going to benefit? Because after Sandy Hook, people went out and purchased guns who had never owned a gun before.
Yeah.
After Sandy Hook, you had a lot of people. Well, when you went to a store to buy ammunition, you had to get in line a half hour before the store opened in order to run into the store and grab the ammunition that you wanted for your gun. Because there was such a run on guns and ammunition. Okay? So this, it just didn't play out the way that they were trying to say. And a lot of the other focus was on things that were just different. I mean, like the porta potty issue.
Yeah.
I mean, those things occur in a mass casualty incident. They just happen because usually there are a lot of NGOs that participate in these events that respond to these events simply because they're part of the community and they want to help if they can. Okay? And the other thing is that, getting back to the drill issue. In a drill, in all the communication between the police, they always have to begin by saying, this is a drill. And at the end of the communication, this is a drill. You never hear those words. You never hear those in any of the communication between the police and headquarters, or when they were responding to each other, talking with each other.
This is interesting because as you're talking, I'm thinking to myself, so the mainstream media, their business is, from my perspective, propaganda. They're reporting Sandy Hook as a shooting, yet when they talk about the shooting, they never bring up the pharmaceutical aspect of it.
Never.
Never. So and, just, and just the shooting. Yeah.
The one broadcast that they did bring it up, it was within a week. That just kind of went dead. Okay. It just,
okay.
You never heard the connection after that.
And then you have the quote-unquote alternative media, which is really a lot of alternative media is controlled opposition.
Of course.
Right? And
yes,
they're putting a different perspective on it.
Yes.
All right.
And then you have CNN, you have Anderson Cooper coming on.
Yeah.
He's interviewing people. And I show in my book how he actually drew attention to the alternative media. Because at one point, let me see the date. It was in late December, early January. He had a program on which he said, now I don't want to talk about this, but I want to just tell you about Dr. James Tracy. And he says, now we don't want to give him too much airtime. And then he goes on to give him a half hour airtime, kept repeating his name, gave out his website. And this caused a lot of people to visit that website who never would have visited the website had it not been for Anderson Cooper saying, now don't look here. Don't look here, guys. Well, of course you're going to look.
Right, right. Well, now, in all fairness, there are alternative media outlets which are legitimate, and they did point to the psychotropics, bringing up the fact that we have another shooter under psychiatric care, taking these drugs. Nobody wants to talk about it. So I just want to make sure that not all of the alternative media is
absolutely.
Is bought and sold.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right, no. I know you weren't saying that. I just want to make sure my audience understands.
Certainly. And not everybody in the alternative media is an operative for the government. You know, and I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah.
But I am saying that there was, if you actually look at the whole thing, I just think that they were trying to cover for the psychiatric industry.
Very interesting.
Because that just, and when you look at the first video that was shot, the CNN video of Robbie Parker, that was the CNN video. And who would just put that out within 24 hours that he was an actor and just take that little, 27 seconds. And then the day after you see it just explode on the internet. Now, who has that kind of power that they're going to disseminate that within 24 hours? And I mean, that is amazing.
Yeah.
That is really amazing.
Yeah, I question a lot of stuff like that too. How do those videos get out there as quickly as they do? But what about the coroner? Because I watched a clip of him and he just looks bizarre.
He is bizarre. Okay. Keep in mind this one thing. The coroner is not independent. He is a government employee. He works for, in this case, he worked for the state. He takes direction from his employer. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when he said, I hope this doesn't fall on their head or it could fall on their head. When he was presented with a FOIA, he decided or somebody decided for him that whatever he found in Adam Lanza's autopsy was a therapeutic dose. Now, if it was a therapeutic dose, he is under the standard of care, as a physician. And he would not release, he only released the top sheet to Abel Child, who submitted the FOIA. And he determined what information he was going to give to them. Now, the assistant attorney general was also in a meeting which was with Abel Child and their attorney, Jonathan Emord. And the assistant attorney general said, we are not going to divulge, I'm paraphrasing, we are not going to divulge the drugs that Adam Lanza may have been taking because we don't want other people to stop taking their medications. Okay?
I actually remember that.
Yes. And so the coroner, keeping in mind that he works for the state, he's not independent. So he has to say what the police tell him to say or what his employer tells him to say.
This is, very, very interesting because it's still a conspiracy, but it's a conspiracy from a different, looking through a different lens. And again, you correct me where I'm wrong here, Deanna, but you still have the government, the media, the pharmaceutical industry. And when we talk about the government, we're talking about the government at the federal, local, and state levels still conspiring in order to be able to keep something under wraps or to protect an interest. In this case, again, from your perspective, it's the pharmaceutical industry.
Right. And Exactly. And the federal government puts a lot of money into the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, yeah.
And when you look at the FDA and the things that they approve of that are dangerous, 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 and when you look at the association between the federal governments, the federal government and the state governments, and the use of pharmaceutical drugs by the states for their programs, whether you're talking about their prisons, whether you're talking about their educational programs, their school districts, or whether you're talking about
the military.
The military?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have 8,000 military people, military personnel per year that commit suicide because of psychiatric drugs.
Right.
That is not reported.
And by the way, they have a lot of these guys and gals that are in the military on multiple psychotropic drugs.
Absolutely.
They're not taking just one cocktails. Exactly.
Right.
A lot of people
don't
know that. I think they're taking one and they're not.
Now, the other thing that you have to remember too is that each state has a Department of Health and Human Services. And, in Connecticut, when I talked with the Assistant Attorney General's office, I said, well, how many Assistant Attorney Generals do you have? And they said, we have about 200. I thought there was just one. Okay. And at least 20 of those people work just in the Department of Health and Human Services. In other words, they have to sell, the federal government and pharmaceutical industry have to sell each state's Department of Health and Human Services on the use of pharmaceutical drugs. Okay? So there's an interest, a financial interest in getting the states to accept pharmaceutical drug protocols within their state. And I give that example in my book, in Texas. It started in Texas with TMAT, where a group of pharmaceutical companies approached the state and wanted to work with them so that they could sell more pharmaceutical drugs in Texas for some particular programs. And it was under Bush, George W. Bush, and they had a program where they worked with these pharmaceutical companies so that they could get a bunch of kids in Texas on psych drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And then that program went to other states. So the idea is to get as many kids as possible on psych drugs.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an evil, evil agenda. It really
yes.
is. It really is.
And it's much more evil than it being a hoax or something. It goes much deeper and it's much more evil and insidious.
Well, they'll get the guns through the back door with psychiatry and the psychotropics anyway.
They don't need our guns. They have our minds.
My point though is that if they really want the guns, I mean, they could, you know, you are not fit to own a firearm. There you go.
Exactly. And, right. and anybody that's on psych drugs cannot purchase a firearm.
Exactly. That's my point. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Deanna, this has been an excellent discussion. I know we never got to the Eisenhower right now camps, but you know what? Would you come back and have that conversation with us?
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you've been so generous with your time. And to be honest with you, I didn't plan on talking about Sandy Hook, but this just got to be so interesting because your perspective is a different perspective because we are being inundated with the whole hoax aspect of it. And so I just thought this was a great show.
Well, the thing is, too, is that when I was talking with my friends, go out to lunch with my friends, and one very educated person says, well, we just need more psych drugs, and this kind of thing wouldn't happen. So there's so many different aspects to look at this. And I said, no, we need less psych drugs.
Right.
So people think, oh, we need more mental health issues. We need more mental health care.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, that perspective is very popular.
Yes.
Very popular.
I wonder why. Could it be because of all those television commercials?
Right.
I wasn't really prepared to talk about Sandy Hook, and so I didn't have any, well, I didn't have my notes or anything. But, yeah, I'm glad that we did talk about this.
Yeah, I am glad too, and it'll be good for your book. And so, Deanna, where can the audience see and hear more of your work? Where can they go to get more of your information and your research?
My website is spingola.com. I also have a website, screeningsandyhook.com, which is brand new. And the company that helped me to self-publish this book also created the website. And so anyway, it has more information about the book. And I have a lot of information on my website. If people just visit my website and click the button, Sandy Hook Research, then they can look at my research.
Yeah, your website has a lot of content.
And pictures and things. Oh, the other thing, too, is that somebody said, well, there were no pictures of Christmas at the school. And, you know, I have pictures of Christmas at school, Christmas decorations. So it's just, anyway.
Yeah, more to learn.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, Deanna, this is, again, it's been excellent. And I want to thank you so much. And what I'll do is I'll have this show out in about a week. And I would love to have you come back in the very near future. In fact, I'll send you an email sometime later today or tomorrow. And maybe we can schedule again and we can talk about Mr. Eisenhower and his Rheinmetall camps. But anyway, Deanna, thank you so much again.
Well, thank you.
All right. And I'll be in touch within the next day or two.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes my interview with Deanna Spingola. And I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. Deanna's website can be found at www.spingola.com. There you will also find links to purchase her books, along with a plethora of information on other research topics. And as always, I'd like to thank everyone for listening and visiting the blog, Sage of Quay Radio, which can be found by heading over to sageofquayradio.blogspot.com or by visiting our hub website at www.sageofquay.com. Also, if you get a moment, please take a listen to my album, Leaving Dystopia, by heading over to laborofloveMusic.com. And remember, live in truth and always serve creation. It's really that simple. See everyone next week. Be safe and joy, and God bless.